We've got the 411 and how election polling works in America. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. So a robust public polling industry is a marker of a free society. Pew Research Center says in nations without robust polling, the head of government can simply decree a citizen's wants and needs. But after, you know, the 2016 presidential election airs, pollsters, they took it on the chin, and we questioned whether polling in our country can produce accurate information. We're going to figure this out. Do you watch the polls, trust the polls, wonder about how they get done? Ask away, 800-642-1234. Barry Burden is a political science professor at UW-Madison and founding director of the Elections Research Center. Barry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And we also have Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor of law and public policy. Charles, welcome back to you as well.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Well, we're going to get into the secret sauce, if you will, the inner workings of polls. But, you know, without further ado, I really want to get to some election results and what you're seeing in the poll results here. The Marquette poll, Charles, you had another poll released yesterday. What were the big takeaways there on the presidential race?
Well, first of all, that Biden leads by 5 points. 48-43, with Libertarian Jorgensen at 2 points, and about 7% that declined to say who they were voting for or said they hadn't made up their minds. That's been very stable, and in many ways, I think the stability of the race this year stands out. We've been between 4 and 6 points in every poll since May, and even longer back to August of 2019. We've had about the same average Biden lead as we have now. So I think those things stand out. Also, likely very high turnout, according to the polling. Higher than 2016, but also higher than 2012, if the poll is an accurate reflection of turnout.
Barry, what do you see out of that, you know, really lack of variability, a very even, steady keel on those polling results?
Well, I agree. It has been a year or a couple of years of real stable, durable patterns. And I think that the foundation for that is built in how people think about President Trump. His approval ratings have been lowish, but rock solid in the low to mid 40s in Wisconsin and nationally for the last several years. And that's about where he stands in the polls that both Charles has done and I have done. One difference in our latest survey is that we show a widening gap between Biden and Trump, with Biden really building his advantage and Trump continuing to hover in the low to mid 40s where he has been. So a little bit of divergence, but I think the story has been consistency. One difference in our poll is that we actually interview the same individuals over time.
Oh, okay.
And that is also proving to show that folks really are not changing their views much. Of people who were with Biden back in July and August, 99% are still with Biden. And for those who were supporting Trump in midsummer, 98% are still saying they're voting for him in October. So very little movement among core supporters.
And Barry, you're looking at Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Is that right? Three swing states.
That's right. We interviewed 800 people in all three states and found actually similar margins across the three states, with Biden up by 10 in Michigan, up by 8 in Pennsylvania, and up by 9 in Wisconsin. And that was a growth in that spread in all three states from where things had been a month ago.
Why do you cluster those three states, those three swing states, as you stick with these same voters? How do you make those decisions?
Well, it was a choice we made early on, really reflecting what had happened in 2016, when all three of these states went narrowly for Trump by about a percentage point in each state. And I think it was a surprising result, it's safe to say, in all three states. It was about 77,000 votes total that divided Clinton and Trump across these three. And it was the outcome in the Electoral College that turned on these states. So we figured they would likely be battleground states again. They mostly still look like battleground states this year. And so I think the Midwest continues to be an important place to watch to understand what's happening in the national race.
We're talking with Barry Burden, who is founding director of UW-Madison's Elections Research Center. Charles Franklin here runs the Marquette Law School poll. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Get all your questions about polls asked, past and present. Have you responded to a poll? What did you think of the questions you were asked? Did they feel neutral or leading? Did you give honest answers? 800-642-1234. You know, Charles, you were on, you know, Barry mentions 2016. You were on ABC's decision desk that night in 2016, watching the returns pile up until 4 a.m. And, you know, you talked to, I guess it was the MIT Technology Review this year and said, you know, nobody wants to be wrong. So in that sense, it was very depressing. What happened?
Well, I mean, the voters had their say. That's the ultimate side. And that's not the depressing side. You know, we are in a country that should be governed by the votes, not by the polls. And I think the nobody wants to be wrong, that's for sure. I'd prefer not to be wrong. But in the end, you know, the vote is, or the outcome is what the voters choose to do. You know, it is, was surprising in 2016 because of the consistency of polling. I don't mean within a poll, but across polls. Mm. Here in Wisconsin, but also in Michigan and Pennsylvania, almost all of the polls had shown Clinton with a lead going into the final week. Now, there's a lot of evidence that the people that decided in the last week broke very heavily for Trump, and that made up a large part of why the polls were as wrong as they were. But in the end, you know, watch the voters decide. And that's what Barry and I have both spent our professional careers doing as political scientists.
I wonder, Barry, you know, some say that the surveys failed to contact enough white voters, less educated white voters, whereas some supporters of Trump, they failed to admit that they were going to vote for him. Was there anything of that going on? What was your assessment of 2016?
Yeah, those are two of the most common theories. I think the theory of the so-called shy Trump voter who didn't want to speak to pollsters is enticing, but doesn't have a lot of evidence behind it. And Charles was part of a postmortem that a polling industry group did after the election, and they went looking for evidence that there were some of these shy Trump voters and couldn't find much support for that idea. We're also not seeing that much this year. Nate Cohn at the New York Times has looked at response rates by registered Republicans and registered Democrats to see if there's something about registered Republicans not willing to participate at the same rate. And he is not finding it even this year. I think there was a problem of pollsters having trouble interviewing enough less educated white voters in 2016. That's a perennial challenge. And some pollsters have changed their practices this year. We might talk about that. Even with those corrections, it doesn't make the problem go away. The main fix has been to ensure that there's an equal or a representative balance of respondents in terms of educational attainment. So we know from the state as a whole, from census data, for example, how many people have college degrees, how many people have graduated from high school, and so on. Making sure that the underlying sample reflects that diversity is an essential starting point. Or to weight the sample once it's been collected to make sure that after the fact you can make it look like the state as a whole. So that's a helpful practice that I think more pollsters are doing this year. But even high quality polling that was done 4 years ago and had those practices in place was also off the mark in states like Wisconsin. So it's not a cure-all, and I think there's still some mystery about exactly what happened 4 years ago.
Barry Burden heads up UW-Madison's Elections Center. Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette poll. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Here's a headline from Vox yesterday. Biden has a lead in the polls, but can we trust them? We're learning about poll-based forecasting. how they assess the state of public opinion, how that leads to prediction. It is your guide to polling here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Charles Franklin, who directs the Marquette Law School poll, and UW-Madison political science professor Barry Burden directs the Elections Research Center. They stay with us. Let's go right to the phones now. Scott is joining us from Luxembourg. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I have a question in relation of the polling with the popular vote versus the Electoral College. My understanding is back in 2016, it did show Clinton well ahead, and she did indeed win the majority of the popular vote, which when you poll people, you get the people's vote. But what actually determines the election is the Electoral College. And I wonder if it's ever been looked at that based upon the Electoral College electors that each state has versus the popular vote, how do the two compare?
Oh, great question, Scott. Well, let's try this first with Charles. Charles, go ahead.
Well, this is, certainly correct that we do choose the president through popular votes, but we elect them through the Electoral College vote. And that distinction matters, as we saw in 2016 and also in 2000. This is one of the great reasons for pollsters like Barry to do three state polls, three critical state polls, given the outcome in the Electoral College in 2016. The good news is if you're polling at the state level, there's not any slippage between the popular vote and the Electoral College vote. That state's Electoral College is determined by the vote within it. So one of the things we've seen this year is in work like Barry's doing, but work by other pollsters and media groups as well, is a lot more emphasis on state-level polling. Mm. And that's very welcome because that is where the outcome of the Electoral College is determined rather than the nationwide popular vote.
Barry, what do you make of that with the Electoral College versus, one vote per person and how the polls look at that?
Yeah, you know, just say one point we sometimes forget is that the national polls in 2016 were quite accurate, maybe meaningless because the popular vote doesn't decide who wins, but pretty close to the mark. They had on average Clinton beating Trump by 3 or 4 percentage points. She won by something like 2.5 points. So within the margin of error and actually more accurate than the polls had been in 2012 and in 2008. But it is the state-level polls that are a better guide to the Electoral College, and they erred in different directions. In the upper Midwest, the polls were too favorable to Clinton, and in other places like Texas and Arkansas, they were actually too favorable to Trump. And so the errors were not even consistent across the country, and that's part of the mystery and why I'm sort of dubious about the shy Trump theory and some of the others that are floating around out there. As long as the Electoral College remains in place, as we know it, state polls are going to continue to be important, and we can only hope we continue to have high quality work like Charles, people who actually know their states and have good track records and can continue to provide insight into what's happening in individual states.
Scott, thanks for the call. Let's bring in Gary now in Iron River with a question. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good morning, folks. I'd like to better understand this margin of error. When you quote a plus or minus 2% margin of error, does that mean each candidate's numbers can go up or down 2%? Or if one goes down, does the other have to go up because you have the same number of pollers or pollees that have to be distributed? Can you just explain that all a bit?
Yeah. Barry, how are margins of error determined?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I wish journalists had more time to explain this to readers and viewers. The margin of error, he's exactly right, does apply to each individual percentage you see in a survey. So if you hear in our survey that Joe Biden is at 53%, that's plus or minus a value. But Trump's percentage of 44 is also plus or minus a value. So if that value were, say, 3%, I think sometimes people will incorrectly assume that if the candidates are more than 3 points apart, then that's outside the margin of error. But that's not how it works because the number applies to each of the percentages. The rough rule of thumb for looking at candidate races is to double the number. So if the margin of error were 3%, you'd actually need a gap of about 6% between the candidates to be confident that that difference was as we would say, statistically significant. So very likely to happen given the data you have. So it's a good question, and I hope one that people continue to pay attention to.
Charles, what do you see for margins of error in your Marquette poll?
Yeah, margin of error is really primarily a function of the size of the sample. It's roughly 1/√ of the sample size, which you can calculate on your phone probably. Mm-hmm. But Barry makes the bigger point, which is it applies to both candidates. But I'm going to be a little bit of a contrarian here. Margin of error is a rock-solid statistical property of random sampling. But in political polling, it becomes less helpful when we devolve into a debate about whether a difference is or is not outside the margin of error, primarily because in conventional statistics and the well-cited margin of error, we're saying we have to be 95% certain that one candidate is leading the other by a statistically significant amount, that is to say, outside the margin of error. That's an appropriate level of certainty for scientific research, but it's a degree of certainty that basically means, as Barry mentioned, you need to roughly double the margin of error. So that means if the margin of error of the sample is 4, you have to see an 8-point margin before it's really 95% certain that one candidate is leading the other. I think for political work and for public opinion work, it's more informative to say a tight race under 3 points, a moderate lead or a modest lead, 4 to 6 points, and, you know, a substantial lead as you get more than that. I think ultimately that's more helpful.
Giving more of a range.
Well, it gives you a notion of mm-hmm. what this is. And the truth of the matter is, when you hear people fighting about differences being in or outside of the margin of error, they're mostly serving a political purpose of, am I really ahead or am I really behind? So like I say, this is a contrarian view. And as somebody that's taught statistics most of his adult life, I feel a little heretical by broaching it. But I do think it's a complicated thing, and maybe we put a little more emphasis on it than we should.
So, Charles,
that's not to say that every margin, no matter how tiny it is, should be treated the same way. A 1-point margin is really close, and we don't really know who's ahead at that point.
Charles, you talked with 806 registered voters for this last round of the Marquette poll. And so I'm certain you arrived then at 806 because as you look for that margin of error.
That is part of the issue. The margin of error, as I said, is a function of sample size. But sample size is also a function of economics. How much can you afford? Mm-hmm. And what's the return on investment, if you want to think of it that way? You know, at one level, Barry and I would be happy to do 1,400 interviews in each state.
What do you think, Barry?
2,000. But yeah, there's a point of diminishing returns very quickly because the margin of error doesn't go down as the sample size goes uh-huh. up. It goes down as the square root of the sample size goes up. And that means to cut your error in half, you've got to quadruple the sample size. And that gets prohibitively expensive very fast.
Well, I didn't know we'd have a math lesson here.
you shouldn't have invited the geeks on if you didn't want to go here.
And Kate, the other reason for having a large sample size is to allow us to look at subgroups in the population. So we'd like to know how men and women are voting or how white and non-white voters are voting. And if the sample's large enough, it provides a reliable way to do that. And just to add to Charles's comments about the margin of error, I'm going to spill some magician's secrets here. The statistical error that comes from a sample is not the only or maybe not even the biggest kind of error that is in a survey like this. We have non-response error from respondents who don't want to do the interview, that won't talk to us. There's measurement error if respondents don't understand the question the way we have worded it. And then there's the very tricky business of trying to figure out who's a likely voter. This is different than measuring other kinds of things. If we were to ask people what brand of toothpaste they used or what day of the week it is. There's sort of an objective answer, and there's not a lot of social desirability going on. Here we're trying to determine who is going to vote when the respondents themselves may not be sure if they're going to vote. There's some uncertainty on their part. We're trying to nail that down. And so it's a, I don't know, nailing Jell-O to a wall. There's some analogy there. We've got a moving target that is changing while the survey is in the field even. And that adds an additional, I think, unknown amount of uncertainty on top of all this margin of error stuff that, as Charles says, is more concrete. And so I think people tend to focus on it.
Barry Burden of UW-Madison, Charles Franklin of Marquette University for the hour, a pair of prominent pollsters in Wisconsin talking about their craft and how polling works in our country and here in Wisconsin. Have you been following the polls? Do you think they're accurate? Do you worry about the way they're leaning? Have you participated in a poll? What format and what did you think of the questions? Did you understand them? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at election polling and getting at your questions on how predictions and modeling all work. National polls try to gauge the opinions of all Americans. The Pew Research Center points out that national polls can be accurate in identifying Americans' preferred candidate, and yet they fail to identify the winner. They're better at giving Americans equal voice than predicting the Electoral College. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, thanks for being here. You can join in. Do you think the polls could be wrong in 2020? What leads you to that conclusion? And we have a veteran Wisconsin pollsters, Charles Franklin of Marquette and Barry Burden of UW-Madison. They stay with us. Let's bring in Nancy now in Milwaukee with thoughts on polling. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. My feeling about polls is and has been for a long time that they have no value whatsoever. They're only giving information about a specific point in time. I heard a writer from The New Yorker, whose last name is Osnos, who recently wrote a biography of Joe Biden. I heard this man interviewed a few days ago, and it threw me into the position of not voting at all this year. I'm refusing to vote for either one, primarily because I learned new information about Joe Biden. And that's what I think the polls fail to understand, is that people may have their minds settled at the time they're answering the questions during the poll. But the next day they may learn additional information and decide that it's inappropriate. Their original thought was very inappropriate.
Yeah, Charles, so, I want to get at Nancy's point there, that polls are just a point in time, a moment in time of measurement of public sentiment.
Well, they certainly are a moment in time. You know, the old story about polls is they're a snapshot in time, not a prediction or a forecast of the future. And that's exactly right. One of the advantages of Barry's methodology of re-interviewing the same people, though, is that you actually do get to see how many people have changed their minds, and you can actually measure that at multiple points in time. So maybe Barry wants to chime in on that, but that's one of the great advantages of re-interviewing.
Yeah, do you see evolution there, Barry?
Not a lot of evolution this year, I think less than we would have seen 4 years ago. And I think that was part of the story 4 years ago, why the polls were off in some of our Midwest battleground states. You know, the polling has to stop at some point. Charles and I need to get out of the field and wrap up the data collection and
nap.
Do the analysis and do the math and appear on shows like this. But the campaign continues. Now, this year, there's much more early voting, but the truth is there are going to be lots of people voting on Election Day. And people do make up their minds near the end of the campaign. There's some evidence that in 2016, late deciding voters broke towards Trump disproportionately. And so,
because there was a large amount of undecided voters in 2016, and they say that, you know, they broke for Trump. How do you look at that undecided category in your data?
Well, I'll jump in on that because we just did that in our release yesterday. About 7% told us that of respondents told us that they hadn't made up their mind or that they declined to say how they voted. And actually, most were in that last category. But earlier in the interview, we had asked them if they had a favorable or unfavorable view of Joe Biden and of Donald Trump. And so what we did was for those who were undecided or didn't say, we allocated them by if they had a favorable view of Biden, but a not favorable view of Trump, we allocated them as likely to be Biden voters. If they had a favorable view of Trump, but unfavorable to Biden, we allocated them to Trump voters. The result is, after doing that, only 2% remain unallocated. Those are the folks that were either favorable to both or unfavorable to both candidates. And the outcome was that it added 2% to Biden's vote to put him at 50, and it added 2% to Trump's vote to put him at 45, and it left the margin between the two unchanged. Now, that still doesn't address the issue that we had in 2016, where after we've interviewed people, the Comey letter came out about Clinton's emails. The last week of the campaign was fairly eventful. And people were making up their minds at the end. There were many more undecideds relatively late in the campaign last time than this time. And that also provided greater opportunity for late switching.
And Dwayne,
and we find that out in the exit polls and in re-interviews where people interviewed before the election were then re-interviewed after the election, much like Barry's design.
We're going to talk about exit polls in a moment, but I want to bring in Dwayne from Weston, who wanted to speak to that point about Comey. And Dwayne, go ahead.
Well, I was thinking, you know, I wouldn't beat yourself up about the polls being wrong. For I think what happened was when Comey reintroduced her, those emails that was going to dump a new batch, that probably took those people that were on the fence and, you know, people were so tired of it. And you think that had anything to do with maybe your polls were right up until that fluid situation with the emails. And that's, you know, that was...
Yeah, Dwayne, breaking up a little bit there, but Barry, what about that very end of the of that campaign and Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, I think everything that's been said here is right. There were more undecided voters and more people who were uncomfortable with both of the candidates. Both Clinton and Trump were underwater in terms of their favorability ratings. And so there were voters searching around for alternatives that were acceptable. A lot of them went to third party candidates. Minor party and independent candidates got 6% of the vote in Wisconsin. That's also a source of trouble for pollsters like us because voters are off. Some voters are deciding, will I show up and vote for Trump or not vote at all? Others are thinking, I'm going to vote. Will it be Trump or will it be Evan McMullen or Gary Johnson? And so the calculus is different for each person.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the Comey letter was a factor, but you know, each day of the campaign brings new information and people being engaged who were not engaged prior. So the best we can do is provide a look at the electorate when the survey is done and let the campaign play itself out.
Barry Burden, who is founding director of UW-Madison's Elections Research Center, is with us. Charles Franklin runs the Marquette Law School poll. You can join in with your questions about polling, how polls work, 800-642-1234. Getting into some of the more nitty-gritty here of how you do these polls, Charles, you do yours by phone, is that right? And you get some
right.
Cell phone numbers as well?
Yeah, oh yes. 60 to 65% of our respondents are interviewed by cell phone.
Okay.
Only about 30 to 35% by landline. But we do use human interviewers, live interviews. They're not robocalls with a machine saying press 1 for Biden, press 2 for Trump. But they're also not done on the internet, which is Barry's methodology. And I'll let Barry talk about internet. But the internet obviously is a newer form of polling, and it's a very promising one.
How do you actually get those numbers?
I'm going to be slightly facetious. We make them up in a very literal sense. You get a list of all of the area codes and exchanges in the state, and you get that for both landline and cell phones. There's no practical distinction in terms of this list. And then you literally generate a random number between 0000-9999, add that to the area code and exchange that you randomly drew, and call that number. And what that does is it gives every number an equal chance of being dialed. And that's how we get a random sample of the population, because we give each number that equal chance of selection. After that, we run into difficulties that not everybody picks up their phone, not everybody agrees to be interviewed. And Barry mentioned that earlier in terms of survey non-response issues, which are very real. But the sampling itself is actually one of the easiest things for how to draw a random sample of phone numbers.
Barry, how does it work for you at the Elections Research Center? Because I understand you also use text and email.
Yeah, totally different methodology for us. We're entirely on the internet. This is something that could not have been done 15 years ago, say, when internet penetration was much lower. We work with the national survey firm YouGov, which has a panel of millions of people who have voluntarily agreed to answer survey questions on a regular basis, most of them about commercial and marketing kinds of questions, like what products they prefer. And in exchange, the people who answer the questions get some rewards, like gift cards and other benefits for participating. Every so often, we sprinkle in some political questions. And so that's what we've done in these three state surveys. When a person signs up to answer questions for YouGov, they complete a demographic profile. That profile then allows us to intentionally select respondents to produce a representative sample. And we've done that in terms of gender, age, race, and education. Those are the four categories where we want to be sure the sample matches up with the state in terms of the census data. So those folks are selected from the pool. They answer questions for us. They're pretty good at answering questions and pretty compliant because they have signed up to do this voluntarily. But it's very different from producing a random sample on the front end, which is the approach Charles has used with the random dialing of phone numbers.
Charles,
there's one other correction we make at the end is to weight the results so that they reflect the vote in 2016. So ensuring for political purposes that we're reflecting the preferences in the state 4 years ago gives us greater confidence that we've got an accurate likely voter sample.
We're looking at the inner workings of polling, how it works. We have two prominent pollsters in Wisconsin, Barry Burden and Charles Franklin. You can join in 800-642-1234. Still time to talk about how polls work and any burning questions on how election polling gets done in our country. What do you think of the polls as you're watching them 5 days from Election Day? We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with veteran Wisconsin pollsters Charles Franklin of Marquette and Barry Burden of UW-Madison. Can we trust the polls ever again after forecasts underestimated President Trump's support in 2016? How reliable are the 2020 forecasts? We're looking at the inner workings of polls with your questions front and center. Let's bring in Mike now in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've listened to conservative talk radio in the past, and I've heard both on a national basis and locally, statewide, that they ask their listeners to mislead the pollsters by not answering the questions, telling them that they're conservative voters. And related to that, most of the people that I talk to who claim to be undecided, when you pry a little bit further, you find out that they're rather conservative. And I wonder if either of those things show up in your work.
Charles, you first.
Well, this year we're seeing that the undecideds are breaking very evenly when we look at favorability to Biden and to Trump, and also when we look at whether you approve or disapprove of Trump's handling of his job. So that is a way of getting some insight into those undecideds. In a different year, like 2016, we would have found that they leaned more to Trump. As for misleading pollsters, first of all, don't do that. That's a bad thing to do. But we're going to ask you 40 questions over the course of the survey. And it's very hard to consistently misrepresent your views across 40 different questions. Are you going to reverse your answer not only to how you're voting, but also whether you approve or disapprove of Trump, have a favorable or unfavorable view of Biden, think Trump has done a good or a bad job on COVID? What about immigration policy? What about wearing masks? In other words, it's really, really hard to genuinely mislead people. And finally, when I listen to interviews, overwhelmingly what I hear people doing is just telling us what they think about politics. And, you know, that's exactly the point. And very few respondents appear to be the sort of extremely politicized folks that would even think it's worth their while to try to lie to a pollster.
Barry, what do you think about misleading on the questions?
Well, it surely happens occasionally, but I endorse everything Charles has said. It's more work for a respondent to try to game the system. Maybe it's entertaining, but it's just much more effortful to try to get that right. And my work has been interviewing the same individuals since February. So they would have to keep this up for, what are we coming on, 10 months or something. So not impossible in a season of Halloween for people to put on a persona and do this, but I think it's unlikely. The good news is we have an election next week. And so we get to find out in the end whether the polls were basically on track or not.
Charles, when you look at the exit polling and the influence or the reasons we do exit polling, what do you see out of those?
Well, I think exit polls are overwhelmingly useful for explaining on election night who's voting for whom and why they're doing that. I think there's an open question about whether their usefulness is that terrific anymore. The Associated Press is now replacing exit polls with a large set of interviews done in the last few days before the election and using that to analyze what the motivations of voters may be. And I think that's a very interesting development. Actually calling races is not something that exit polls are much used for, even though I think in the public mind they're associated with you know, who wins and who doesn't. But really, they're far more useful for knowing which demographics voted which way and which opinions supported each presidential choice.
Another question along the lines of those phone numbers, Charles, that you generate. Do Wisconsin residents who moved here from out of state still have those cell phone numbers, like myself with a 318 area code, but I don't live in Louisiana? Do their numbers factor into possible respondents?
No, and that actually is one of the problems with my polling methodology. The good news is the percentage of people within the state with out-of-state phone numbers is not negligible, but it is still pretty small, and so its practical effect is low. We have no trouble with people who took their 608 area code and moved out of state, because one of the first questions we ask is, where do you still live? Are you registered to vote in Wisconsin?
Yeah.
But certainly people who move in are problematic. That is one of the advantages of a different sampling methodology that a lot of pollsters use, including the New York Times Siena poll, which I think is supposed to be out for Wisconsin in the next day or two. They sample from a list of registered voters. So as long as there's your, you know, Louisiana phone number associated with your registration here in the state, those kinds of listed voters will be reached by that methodology. There are a lot of advantages to listed voters. On the other hand, the advantage of my method is I can reach new people who weren't on the voter registration list before. And so there are trade-offs between these two methods. But the foreign numbers that are living in Wisconsin are an area that I miss.
Well, we'll come around one day or another. It's only a matter of time. Let's bring in Karen now in Madison. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have a question about polling and if you have any idea about how misinformed voters are. And like in the last election, Russia was involved in misinformation and actually candidates tell lies too. But what part of the public did not vote because they were so confused, disgusted, and also people voted on false information.
Yeah, Karen, thank you. And Barry, I want to pose that to you. What is the effect of misinformation and disinformation at the ballot box? Can you measure that?
Yes, I think so. Our surveys don't ask a lot of those kinds of factual questions as a test to see what people know or what their beliefs are. We sort of take the electorate as it is. We ask questions like what issues are important to people, their evaluations of the governor and of the president on a variety of issues, and just want to reflect that rather than try to shape it or correct it. I think this is a good place to draw a line between the kind of academic measurement that Charles and I are doing, trying to get a read on the electorate, versus what are called push polls that can be done by campaigns or third-party groups that are really trying to drive opinion by using leading questions, enticing people maybe with misinformation or selective information. That's just a very different approach than our kind of taking the temperature of the electorate. People do come to the voting decision with lots of different information. I'll give you one example from our survey. We asked people, which of 11 issues do you think is the most important in the country? Among Democrats, Biden voters, that is, coronavirus was number one by far. And after that, I think the economy and healthcare were the next two, but they were pretty far down the list. But Republicans saw the world were differently. Coronavirus was not the top issue, and there was sort of more of a mix of things, including the economy. So that's just fine. Those are voters' perspectives, and we want to share them.
We only have a few seconds left, but do you each write your questions for your polls?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, both do. Yeah. How is that writing? I mean, is it hard to shape those questions? Does it just come to you?
No, you actually take classes in that in graduate school. You're doing it. Seriously, the goal of most pollsters, and certainly the kind that Barry and I do, is don't include a lot of adjectives and don't include cues that would suggest a right answer. And so our questions are actually exercises in uncreative writing. try to be as clear and direct as possible and don't lead people.
I think you just opened a whole nother conversation. Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette Law School poll, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Barry Burden, founding director of the Elections Research Center. Barry, thank you for your time.
Glad to be here.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.